You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that the Senate would delay the vote on the Republicans' health care bill. We'll talk about that news and the Congressional Budget Office report released yesterday.
First, the Supreme Court gave the green light yesterday for parts of President Trump's travel ban to go into effect. The full ban, which targeted six Muslim-majority nations, will be considered by the Supreme Court in the fall.
The court has allowed a scaled-back version of the president's immigration policy to go into effect, but critics still say that it is discriminatory and functions as a de facto ban on Muslims. But on Twitter, President Trump said he was grateful for the Supreme Court's decision, adding, quote, "We must keep America safe."
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He joins us now for a look at the future of the travel ban. Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, the key word here in this ruling for now seems to be partial. And what does that mean? How many people are going to be affected now that part of the travel ban is in place?
Well, that's a great and really central question, because the court, on the one hand, allowed part of the ban to go into effect, but it created a huge exception. In other words, that the ban is still blocked as to a lot of people. And what the court said is that the ban can't be applied to foreign nationals with a bona fide relationship with an individual or an entity in the United States. And that is a huge number of people who would have been affected by the ban. And so in that sense, if it's a partial victory for the executive order, it's really just a fraction of what I think the president was trying to accomplish.
Right. Let's look at who would have been covered under the full ban and is not now covered under that restriction you just mentioned of having that connection with someone in the United States. What kind of categories of people now can come here that couldn't have under the full ban?
Well, you know, the phrase bona fide relationship with an individual or entity in the United States, could be very vague. And I think there's going to be some areas where it is going to have to be litigated in a lot of gray areas. And it'll create a great deal of uncertainty in those gray areas. But one thing the court did, which I think was very helpful, is it listed some examples what the court thought would be clearly qualifying as having a bona fide relationship with a U.S. individual or entity. So to answer your question, one thing is immigrants sponsored by U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So that would be one example. Another is non-citizens who've accepted a job offer from a U.S. employer. Another example is non-citizens admitted to U.S. educational institutions to study. Another is non-citizens invited to speak to U.S. audiences. And interestingly, it took a pretty broad view of this in saying that, giving as an example, people who are coming essentially to visit, really on tourist visas, visit relatives in the United States. And so when you think about the number of people who come to this country, so many people who come to this country really need a connection with a U.S. employer or with a relative anyway, or with an educational institution because they've been admitted. And so in this sense, while there's a lot of gray area, and I think there are a lot of aspects of the ban that are still troubling to a lot of people, numerically, the ban doesn't cover anywhere near the number of people that I think the executive order was originally going to cover.
One possible gray area is a refugee who wants to come to the United States who has a relationship with a refugee resettlement organization. Does that count as the kind of relationship that would exempt someone from the ban?
Well, that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think that it really depends on how courts, other courts, lower courts, construe what it means to have this relationship, right? It's a bona fide relationship with a U.S. entity or a citizen. Now, it turns out a lot of refugees who are settled in the United States actually do have relatives here. So we know from what the court said that those folks would be allowed in. And the court was very clear that this is going to go this can go above the lowered cap that the executive order, you know, the executive order tried to cut the number of refugees admitted this year and a little bit under half of the original amount. And so you've got a situation where a lot of these refugees have relatives here, and so they'll be exempt from the ban. The question you raise is, you know, what happens if it's a refugee resettlement agency? Well, I mean, I'm not sure why the court would have used the phrase entity in that context if it weren't, you know, having in mind some of these agencies. So my thought here is that it should qualify, but I think the courts will have the final word on this, of course. And this is another one of these areas. I mean, give you another gray area. The court talked about close relatives or family members of the United States. I'm not sure exactly how the court said that, the Supreme Court. I'm not sure how lower courts will construe that. But you know, I think it's really significant that the court, the Supreme Court, reached beyond what you have to do to sponsor someone. In other words, like, you, for example, you can be sponsored by a citizen spouse. Spouse is a U.S. citizen. They can sponsor you. That's clearly qualified or clearly covered by the protection of the injunction. In other words, the travel ban won't apply to them. You know, you cannot get sponsored to this country by a grandparent, for example. But, you know, the court's language seems to suggest that it's not just the person who can sponsor you, but it's a wider circle of relatives. But this is another gray area. So I think the refugee one is a gray area. I think that the scope of relatives is a gray area. And I think the refugee example you gave is a bona fide relationship with a U.S. entity. But, you know, it's the courts will have to sort that out, and I think they're going to have to sort it out pretty soon because these cases are going to come up. You know, if I could just take a second to give you a kind of a more conceptual answer here. I think the court here was really concerned. The Supreme Court was really concerned about hurting people in the United States, companies, individuals, universities, et cetera. And so, one of the things here is one of the ways to understand what it means to have a bona fide relationship with a citizen or entity inside the United States is, you know, is there someone who's being hurt? He can make a claim and can sue that their mission is hurt or their family life is hurt. And, you know, I think that ought to be the way the courts construe it. But I'd be the first to admit to you that there's a lot of ambiguity in the phrase bona fide relationship, even though the court, I think, was very helpful in providing some examples of this.
Hiroshi Motomura is with us from UCLA's School of Law, looking at the Supreme Court and the president's travel ban. A couple of constitutional issues at stake here when it comes to how the country handles immigration. One of them is, how much latitude does the president, the administration, have to stop immigration from, in this case, selected countries for national security reasons? Did we learn anything about the Supreme Court's attitude toward that from what we saw yesterday?
A little bit. It's hard to say. I mean, we know that three justices wrote a separate opinion that expressed their view that the president really ought to have a huge amount of latitude. And so they, those three justices seem to take a view of very strong presidential and congressional power on this. But the other six justices, it's really hard to say. I think that the fact that they essentially kept in place the injunction, in other words, to put it more in plainer English, I mean, they basically kept out of action, kept from taking effect this travel ban as to huge bunches of people, probably most of the people that it affected most directly. That actually just signals that they're willing to take a strong look at this. But it's always been an issue about the balancing national security and essentially whether immigration policy hurts people and whether constitutional rights are trampled upon. I should also add that the lower courts in this case were not just worried about the Constitution here. You know, they did say that that there's a problem here, but there may not be a enough of a basis for this ban. Another thing that the courts are really concerned about is the separation of church and state, and whether this was essentially a Muslim ban, or at least directed against Muslims. Or
right, and did this, I wanted to ask that next. Did the Supreme Court give an indication of what they thought about that religious discrimination angle?
No, I mean, it's not directly. Not directly. What the court did, though, was very interesting, is it basically it basically said that the ban could not go into effect with regards to huge bunches of people inside the United States. And that's a very interesting thing because it signals to me that the court is really going to take seriously the interests of people in the United States, whether it's citizens or companies or other people who are hurt. And one of the ways that the argument that's being made about how those folks might be hurt is because this is essentially disparaging or disadvantaging a religion of Islam. And so I think that the court's willingness to essentially block the ban in all these cases signals some willingness to look at this. You know, I should also add here that, you know, it's been historically really hard. Our courts have been reluctant to take into account constitutional claims in immigration cases. It's historically been really hard to say the government's keeping me out. The government won't let my relative in, and that's unconstitutional. It's been really hard to say that. And one of the strategies that a lot of challengers, in other words, people who are upset with the immigration decisions of the U.S. government, one of the things that the challengers have often said is, but look at the U.S. citizens who are affected. Look at them. And try to get some traction that way. And the Supreme Court and lower courts have been reluctant to take that view, because if you think about it, I mean, so many people are affected by immigration decisions that opening it up to looking at who would be hurt in the United States, U.S. citizens who are hurt, would really gut the traditional insulation of these immigration decisions from court scrutiny. So the fact that the court was willing to look at exactly, not exactly, but to look and take into account the effect on U.S. citizens, it may signal an opening to look more exactly at what the administration did here. One thing I want to add, too, is that this is completing an earlier thought, that it wasn't just constitutional problems that the lower court saw in this matter. One of the things that especially the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the West Coast saw is that the president has to follow certain procedures to go through and do the things he did in executive order, and he didn't follow those procedures, and he didn't make those determinations. And so there's a strong argument here that the executive orders, whether or not they're constitutional, they actually violate the statute. And we have to bear in mind here that this is the president acting by executive order within the framework of a structure set up by Congress. And so there's a couple of reasons conceptually why the president might be going beyond his legal power. One is he could violate the Constitution. But the other is that he could be essentially acting in violation of the framework that Congress set out.
Hiroshi Monomura is with us, scholar of immigration and citizenship at UCLA's School of Law. We're looking at the partially reinstated travel ban and the future of President Trump's executive order targeting six majority Muslim countries.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the Supreme Court's decision to reinstate part of President Trump's travel ban? Do you think that banning people who don't have a bona fide relationship with people or entities in the U.S. is a good policy, and the Supreme Court will consider the ban in full in the fall? What do you think that decision should be? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Hiroshi Monomura. He is a scholar of immigration and citizenship at UCLA's School of Law. We're looking at President Trump's travel ban. The U.S. Supreme Court said it would consider the ban this fall after it reinstated parts of it yesterday.
You can join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What decision are you hoping the Supreme Court comes to on the president's full travel ban? Are you or is your family Muslim or from any of the countries mentioned in the ban? And if you're concerned about national security, tell us if you think whether or not this is something President Trump's order would make America safer with. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Richard on the line in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think that the ban should never have been banned in the first place. I think President Trump was on the right track, and he's thinking more of the protection of this nation, of its citizens, than he is citizens of other countries. And I think there should be a lot more scrutiny in who we let into this country. After all, I believe the Constitution was written for the citizens of the United States, not for the world.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, hitting some of the arguments, of course, that the Trump administration has been making. Hiroshi, the president has, he says, the right to think of national security that overrides the interest in open immigration. Certainly, he would say, and it makes us safer. What do you think of what Richard has to say, Hiroshi?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, national security is very important, but I think the way the caller set this up is to say that the Constitution, as he said, is written for the citizens and not for, I guess, people outside. I forget exactly how he phrased it. And so, you know, even if you take that to be true, and there is a lot of there's a fair amount of truth to that. The way the court resolved this, at least temporarily, takes into account the rights of U.S. citizens. In other words, you've got U.S. citizens who have family members, for example, in these six countries. You've got U.S. citizens who don't have family members in those countries. And so what the court is really doing is taking into account and saying, okay, the Constitution is for citizens, but some of those citizens have some real close family members they've been waiting to petition for, sponsor for a number of years. And so I don't think it's a question of sort of immigrants or all these folks are outside and they're all trying to get in and that we are just trying to keep them out. I think that there's a balancing here between a number of things, citizens who have particular interests in bringing in family members, citizens who don't. And then the other things here is how much we're going to go. I think the court's very concerned, certainly lower court's very concerned, with how much in making that calculus between national security and constitutional rights, how much we err so much on the side of national security that we start lumping people into groups based on religion or race or ethnicity. I think that the country has a long history of discrimination in the context of immigration. I think that that casts a shadow over what the court is trying to do. One example of that, and just one of many examples, is Japanese internment during World War II, which essentially said, well, you know, we don't really care about the rights of U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry. So I think the caller makes a point that I think I understand where it's coming from, but I think we've got to think about the fact that this country has all kinds of citizens and interests with regard to immigration, and that's true for all the universities. That's true for companies that are wanting to hire U.S. citizens as well.
Thanks for the call, Richard. We'll go next to Abraham in Green Bay. Abraham, hi.
Hi. I am an American citizen today, and when I came to this country, I came as a 13-year-old refugee born in Kenya. I did not have at the time any bona fide relationships or connections in the United States. I'm involved in the local community here and at the university. I'm a full-time employee of a local employer here. And I'm fully contributing to this country and this society today. And this idea that you must have some form of, you know, connection, specifically a bona fide connection, I think is very detrimental to the very American idea that everyone in this country the very American idea that this country is a country of hope and of liberty and freedom. I mean, we were gifted the Statue of Liberty with incredible writings as a symbol of hope for not only Europe but also the whole world, and we serve as one today.
Abraham, thanks for the call. And Abraham worried there, Hiroshi, that maybe his counterpart in one of those six countries might not get the opportunity he did.
Well, I mean, I essentially agree with what he was saying from the perspective as who is hurt. In the following sense, that I can see why the court went to this bona fide relationship with the U.S. entity or person. I can see why they did that, because they're really trying to balance, you know, what they're going to do while this case is being argued, and they're trying to figure out what do we do right now until we can come up with a final decision. So in that sense, they're balancing. But I think that one of the things that I'm concerned with, and I suppose I share your caller's view on this, is that there are a lot of people who are hurt by the full travel ban who wouldn't be able to show a bona fide relationship with the United States. I think that there's a strong argument that this is associated enough with the president's statements, both during the campaign but also around the time he took office, suggesting that it's targeting a religion. And so if that's the case, then it's going to be then I think that it hurts people who are really going to be hurt by anything that's directed against that religion. So, but I want to point out just the fact that the court took this test on the bona fide relationship now in terms of balancing what to do in the interim. It may or may not have implications for what the court's going to do ultimately. I mean, the court may decide that was the way they're going to maintain the status quo, But they're going to come up with a different decision when it really comes down to deciding this finally. And I'm sure it doesn't take a crystal ball to say this is going to be a close case.
Abraham, thanks for the call. Briefly, I want to get into another argument from the Trump administration that Syria and the other countries on the list, part of the problem they say is we can't get enough information from those countries to do an appropriate background check. That's part of why we need to put off refugees and immigrants and visitors coming from those countries. What's your take on that as we start to wrap up?
Well, a couple things. One is that the refugees, if you're focusing on refugees, but really throughout the whole process, there's been talk of extreme vetting. There's been extreme vetting going on for a very long time. It takes several years of multiple background checks to get in. And so this is apparently something that's been happening for some time. So that's one. The other is another subtle point about the Supreme Court decision. What the order will end up doing, and this will go into effect, is there'll be a review conducted of the vetting procedures. And so, you know, that review may end up becoming conducted, and the order would end up essentially expiring in late September. And if that's the case, then the case will actually go away. It'll be moot, as lawyers say, and there won't be a case for the court to decide. And that's actually one of the issues that the court asked the parties to brief. In other words, is there even going to be a case when you get to October? And it's possible that there'll be a new version of some type of travel ban. It could also be that we're going to move to a completely different approach, which is to rely essentially on what the president's called extreme vetting. And so that's another uncertainty here.
Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Hiroshi Motomura. He's a professor at UCLA's School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He joined us for a look at the future of the president's travel ban after the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated parts of it yesterday.
Yesterday, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released its report on the Senate Republicans' version of the health care bill. Their numbers show that the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act would cause about 22 million more Americans to be uninsured by the end of the coming decade. The report also showed this bill would reduce federal spending by $321 billion during that time.
Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told senators he's going to delay a vote on the health care bill until after the Senate's week-long July 4th recess, contrary to their original plans. Here he is talking to the press today.
Legislation of this complexity almost always takes longer than anybody else would hope. But we're going to press on. We think the status quo is unsustainable for all the obvious reasons we've discussed over and over and over again.
Tom Oliver joins us now. He's a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
So what is your take on how this CBO report on the Republican health care bill went over yesterday?
Well, it's just a signpost in a long process that tries to put a nonpartisan scorekeeping or referee kind of thing in this process that sort of says, to the best guesstimate of experts, health economists and policy analysts who've looked at the impact of changes in the health system over a number of years, where will this be over a period of time? And they have a 10-year window to look at. So what the CBO is reporting on is how this specific piece of legislation, not the one that passed the House a few weeks ago, how will this one come out in the wash in terms of the number of people uninsured, the number of people paying more, number of people paying less for health insurance, and a variety of other things that have impacts on our health system and obviously on population health as a whole.
You use the term tries to put a nonpartisan scorecard out there. It's interesting because at this state, President Trump has cast some doubt on whether or not this is an accurate measure from the Congressional Budget Office. So what do you think about how accurate the measure is?
Well, you can't be precise in estimating the impact of anything on a $3.5 trillion annual health care spending in our country. But the Congressional Budget Office has a better track record than just about any other analysts, and it's also officially something that Congress has to accept. The people serve both Republicans and Democrats. And so obviously on both sides, you'll hear a lot of spin and a lot of potential exaggeration or, you know, misinterpretation of what's being said. But the CBO is a important thing for people to look at and say, again, what do experts actually have to say about what's likely to happen?
And we heard just a bit ago Senator Mitch McConnell saying this is complex legislation and sometimes it takes longer than those involved would like. And so there's been a delay on the vote on this bill. Were you surprised to hear that?
Well, I guess it depends what I'm surprised. I know the Republicans really have spent so many years criticizing the Affordable Care Act and its impact. They feel very compelled to come up with a vote and then come up with the differences, you know, figure out how they can get the House and Senate together and push through something to, you know, follow up on their election promises. The thing about it taking a long time is a little bit silly because they've done all this in just a couple of months. The Affordable Care Act, it took over a year and a couple months to go through hundreds of hearings and hear from experts and testimony. They accepted a lot of amendments. None of this has been allowed on the House or Senate floor, and so it's really being slammed through as quickly as possible. But they've now run up against the fact that they don't quite have 53 votes in the Senate, if necessary, to push it through.
And we have a little bit from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on this.
CBO's report today makes clear that this bill is every bit as mean as the House bill. This CBO report should be the end of the road for Trump care. Republicans would be wise to read it like a giant stop sign, urging them to turn back from this path that would be disastrous for the country, for middle-class Americans, and for their party.
So we do have this delay in the vote, maybe not a full stop from Republicans, but do you think this CBO report is part of the reason that we're seeing this delay and could see further maybe changes to the bill before a vote?
Well, yeah, the information that comes out, again, the best that we can get from experts who presumably don't have a direct stake in the outcome and are trying to, you know, tell as best as possible what the truth is about these things. It's a stop sign because it's creating reactions on both sides, more liberal and more conservative sides. The reason you can't go to a vote in the Senate is because a number of senators, including Senator Johnson from Wisconsin, think it still preserves too much of the Affordable Care Act and some of the help that came to people to get insurance in the private insurance market as well as in the Medicaid. And there's also a couple of senators who are a little more squeamish, sort of more toward the middle of the political spectrum, most notably Senator Collins from Maine. This does affect hundreds of millions of people in this country. I mean, almost everybody would have some personal impact as to what's going on here. From everything from hundreds of dollars to thousands and thousands of dollars every single year for individuals or families. And so that's why I think there's a little bit stepping back, because they are hearing from normal people who might be ordinarily wanting to support Republicans, but this is something that's coming home potentially to root with their families, particularly families with someone with chronic conditions, severe disabilities, mental health conditions. 30% of people with opioid addiction, which is now across the entire country, are getting Medicaid coverage. Half of all births in this country are to mothers who have Medicaid coverage. These things, which are built in as major rollbacks in the proposed legislation, could really wake up people as to what might happen to them and their ability to get affordable, quality health care.
We're talking with Tom Oliver right now from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the Congressional Budget Office's new report on the Senate Republicans' health care bill. And Tom, you said that this bill is going to impact everybody. Let's get into some of that impact. Again, the CBO reporting that 22 million more people would be without insurance by 2026. Where do you see the greatest impact? Who gets impacted the most?
Well, right out of the starting gate, about 15 million people would be projected to lose coverage in the first year if this particular version of healthcare reform became law. Then ultimately, as you noted in your the news, up to 22 million. So that puts us right back where we were in the middle of the Great Recession, where almost 50 million Americans didn't have insurance coverage. So we've made a lot of progress since then, and now those people are facing the likelihood that either coverage at no cost if they're very low income, or coverage at somewhat less cost if they're lower to middle income would be, you know, threatened. That what happens in these both the House and Senate law bills is that the premiums for very young healthy people would go down somewhat. But if you already have some existing conditions, or you're older and you're lower or middle income, you are likely facing higher premiums and out-of-pocket costs, sometimes to the tune of many thousands of dollars. So if you're, say, 58 years old and you don't have access to a large group insurance plan, your costs could go up by well over $10,000 every single year under this bill compared with the subsidies available under the Affordable Care Act.
And this report also stating that the Senate bill would reduce the federal deficit by $321 billion by 2026. How does it get there?
Well, that's a lot of money, but in perspective, that's less than 1% of national health care spending per year over that time. So we spend well over $3 trillion a year as a nation. And so this is really slicing off a tiny bit of what we spend as a country. But how it gets there is very large savings from the federal government has been paying the states almost all of their costs for expanding Medicaid coverage by, 10, 15 million people have gotten that expanded coverage. So it pulls back on that, back to its normal cost sharing over the next few years. And then at the same time, it also cuts the percentage, it cuts the amount per person per year on Medicaid that would go to the states. And so that's where, over a very short period of time, that cap begins to cut into the expected amount of money that would be going to the states. You have to keep in mind that one out of five people in this whole country are now on Medicaid. It's not just for low-income people. There's a lot of medium income people and others who have some serious health conditions so that keeps them from working and so forth. They're really relying heavily on Medicaid. So it cuts back on Medicaid, and that begins to affect the program that provides long-term care support for nursing homes if you need it. It provides mental health. It provides a lot of dental health for individuals. So there's a lot of things that go out if Medicaid gets cut. The other side of that is it doesn't save as much money as it might because it gives back tax cuts to health insurance plans and also very high-income individuals who are contributing towards the expanded coverage in the Affordable Care Act.
Tom Oliver is with us right now from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the Congressional Budget Office's new report on the Senate Republicans' health care bill.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this new report, about the direction the Senate is going on health care? What would you like to see happen? How would it all affect you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our discussion now about the CBO report on the Senate Republicans' health care bill, which shows an estimated 22 million more people would be uninsured by the end of the coming decade. Senator McConnell, Republican leader from Kentucky, just delayed the vote on the health care bill until after the Senate's week-long 4th of July recess.
Tom Oliver is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jerry on the line with us in Armstrong Creek. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
My comment is I want to dispel this fiction about if you create competition, that the cost is going to go down. Because when you're trying to use a business model, no business that sells a product or a service can give that product away for free. When somebody gets hurt or gets into an accident and they don't have insurance or can't pay the bill, they're still going to get care, and that's going to get paid for by someone, and that someone is going to be everybody else that pays for insurance, and that's going to actually increase the cost. So using a business model in healthcare just doesn't work.
Jerry, thanks for that. And Tom, what do you say to that? Jerry's saying the business model with competition between insurance carriers is not going to work here.
Well, by and large, I completely agree with Jerry. The thing that actually reduces costs for everybody is to build very large pools so that you have young and old, you have healthy and not very healthy people all in a very large pool, and that's what these health insurance exchanges were intended to do. And that allows insurers to, spread the risk and also be a lot more sure about what their costs are going to be. So the philosophy of standing on your own 2 feet for almost all of us is really unsustainable the minute we get sick. And as Jerry pointed out, if we get sick and we can't pay our bills and the charges, if you've ever seen them from the healthcare system, are very substantial, then that does tend to be passed on to others across the system. So it's really, do we want everybody in it and we're sharing up front, or do we want to sort of get at it very backwards?
Jerry, thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Thomas in Richland Center. Thomas, hi.
Howdy. My comment was about the insurance itself. When about in 2015, me and my wife were looking at getting insurance, and we ended up finding insurance that was actually cheaper than going through a approved Obamacare insurance. But it was not covered. It wasn't approved by Obamacare. So therefore, at the end of the year, I would sit there and be. Me and my wife would both still get hit with a penalty for not having approved insurance.
Thomas, thank you for that that story there. Tom, what do you make of that? Tom saying the exchanges didn't yield what they were supposed to for him, and he ended up getting dinged with a fine.
Well, Thomas is in a boat with a few other million Americans, but not a very large proportion of Americans. So what you were able to do, I think because you probably had some good health in your family, was get hold of old plans that didn't have to cover as many benefits as the Obamacare requirements. And so you could get a good deal on that. But, of course, if you did get sick, then those plans would become very, very expensive, and you'd probably be better off going into the exchange. But this is, again, a philosophical thing about how much should we have everybody operating under the same rules. And to the extent there's some plans that can be much thinner in their coverage and others much more comprehensive, we're going to end up splitting the risk. And as long as you're young and healthy or just healthy, you'll get really good deals. But as soon as you have some pre-existing conditions or have some significant health care needs, you're going to be thrown into this other much more expensive pool. And that's the question then, are there subsidies to cover and make it affordable?
Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Very complicated, but I hope we can have more conversations like this as we go along.
Appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll talk further. That was Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, joining us there to talk about the new CBO report on the Senate Republicans' health care bill and the delayed vote on that bill.
Fish farming in Wisconsin has traditionally centered around raising bait for the state's anglers, but after a 10-year lull, the state's aquaculture industry is seeing growth, and new farms are raising fish destined for our dinner plates. Rich Kramer has the latest installment of our series, State of Change.
On a hill overlooking the small town of Northfield, just off I-94, a green metal building, 2 acres of plexiglass, and a red barn stand out in the surrounding sea of farm fields. It's a fish farm capable of producing 160,000 pounds of Atlantic salmon and rainbow trout, along with a greenhouse that can grow up to 2 million pounds of lettuce per year. The business is called Superior Fresh. Brandon Gottsacker is the general manager. He says it's the first indoor Atlantic salmon aquaculture facility in the U.S., and by using lights to simulate changing seasons, Gottsacker claims they can grow their fish at least a year faster than in the wild.
Inside our building, we can grow these fish a little bit quicker than outdoor farms because we give the fish an optimum environment to live in their entire life. So we avoid winters and super cold water that would slow a fish's metabolism down and ultimately its growth.
There are currently around 60,000 salmon and trout in their tanks, and Gottsacker hopes to add 15,000 more next year. That creates a lot of waste that, in traditional fish farming, can make its way into rivers and streams. But production manager Bruno Cerozzi says that waste feeds their other cash crop.
We feed the fish. They will take the nutrients that they need to grow. And all the nutrients that they don't use, we recycle through the plants.
In the greenhouse next door, head grower Adam Schinner stands next to floating mats with 24,000 heads of romaine, red leaf, and butter lettuce, which he says grow nearly twice as fast as in the field. He says with a growing population, high-tech farms like this will become vital in providing nutritious, local food to the masses.
I definitely believe this is the way of the future. The amount of space we utilize here is so much less than traditional agriculture. And we can keep this production going year-round, which is definitely something that's going to be needed, especially in northern hemispheres.
There are 2,500 registered fish farms in Wisconsin, but only around 350 raise fish as a business. According to USDA statistics, the number of Wisconsin fish farms declined between 2005 and 2013. Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst wants to change that, and a bill of his, which eases regulations for fish farming, was recently signed by Governor Scott Walker.
We have a very highly regulated industry, and it discourages people from expanding into aquaculture. And there's just such great possibilities here in Wisconsin. We have the water resource to be able to do it.
Tiffany says the aim of his bill is to treat aquaculture more like traditional agriculture. But that doesn't sit well with some environmental groups. Sarah Gears is an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates, which opposed the legislation.
We're concerned that those existing regulatory standards aren't tailored for this very different industry. So it's like agriculture in a way, but also totally different than growing crops in a field.
Whether Tiffany's bill will spur an aquaculture revolution in Wisconsin remains to be seen. But Chris Hartleb of the UW-Stevens Point Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility says new growth is breaking a decade of stagnation in the industry.
I would say in the past 3 years, there's this kind of resurgence in Wisconsin aquaculture where not only are new businesses starting to open up, but it's younger generation people starting those businesses.
The team at Superior Fresh in Jackson County is part of that next generation of fish farmers, and they're excited for the future. If all goes well, the company says it could build a new operation 10 times bigger than the facility in Northfield. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of WPR's year-long series, State of Change.